Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris. What's going on? It's Isaac here at Inappropriate Happiness, sitting with the one and only K-A-R-I-N-A Reichman, Karina Reichman, who sat in with the band Mo this weekend at the Palace Theater in Albany. Karina, how you doing?
I boogs. What's up, pal? Great to see you. Great to hear from you. I'm fantastic. I did do that. That was cool, man. That was fun. And you were there.
I was. It was a very feel-good time.
I would say there was nothing that didn't feel good about it, you know? It was a very incredible sort of wholesome yet rock and roll yet really, you know, all around good family feel good time. I would agree with that. We love the guys in Mo.
We love the Palace Theater.
We literally love the Palace Theater. The Palace Theater is so fabulous. And it was really nice to sort of soak in the vibe and have two weekends with the band Mo. It was super, super fun. And it was great. Like, you know, to play a theater that looks like that is just kind of crazy. Like, you're just like, wait, what? I'm in a theater now? Like, we do theater gigs? This is amazing. And my band opened up, which was super, super fun. And then after, you know, Mo invited me up for last song in the first set, which is a song called Meat, that they put out as a 45-minute long single back in the day.
They did, correct? Yes. Studio release, 45 minutes.
That is just unbelievable. And I like that. I like that about them. And it was really fun to learn it. And I basically, you know, I let the first half of the tune kind of happen. And then there's basically a big bass moment where I walked on with my wireless bass when Rob kind of waved me in, which was very exciting. You know, you kind of join something that's already happening in this really fun way, and you're like, oh shit, I'm stepping into your world now. And it really does feel like a whole other world on stage, you know. And I had in-ear monitors for that, which I don't usually have, and I was sort of very immersive in its way that it always is when you do shit like that. And we had a bass conversation. It wasn't even a bass off, it was a conversation. It was very interesting and very, very cool. And you know, it sort of started off kind of slow and meditative and just kind of like grooving. And then I kept on, like, Rob would keep escalating it, you know. It's like, and we had all these sort of same pedals on our boards. We have the octave, the Tim LaFave octave pedal that I can't stop talking about or using for that matter. And he like went to hit his, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to hit mine too, you know, which is great. And then he started slapping, and I was like, all right, I'm going to slap too, you know? And then it was just, it kind of kept going. And I've watched it several times, which is really fun. And I'm like, wow, like, this was really one of my favorite sit-ins I've ever done. This was really, really cool. There was something so kind of organic and exciting and natural about playing with Rob and with the guys, you know, which I sort of, I didn't see it coming, you know. I was like, this is very cool.
Well, it was your second sit-in in the last 6 months with two bases, the first being with Mike Gordon at Nectar's.
Right.
And, you know, the two-base sit-in can be an intimidating thing, a hard thing to kind of conceptualize, difficult thing to pull off, and also make entertaining. And I think both were very distinctly different, and also, you know, as you're saying, real kind of conversations.
I agree, and it is. It's rarely done for good reason. I would argue, like it's not an easy thing to pull off, and it's not an easy thing to conceptualize. It's like very, you know, we're looking at basically two monophonic, for the most part, instruments, you know, meaning you usually just play one note at once, not several, like it's not a chordal instrument where you're kind of, you know, it's hard to have two of them dance around each other. And it's very like, I don't know, it's a crazy thing. And of course, like, you know, to play with both of them, those are bass players I've looked up to kind of my whole life, you know, and it's kind of crazy that I, you know, one of them sat in with my band, I sat in with the other one's band. Like it was very interesting. And yeah, it's hard to not draw comparisons between the two because you're kind of like, wow, like these guys have been doing this for like longer than I've been alive, you know? And it's just so crazy to like play with people who've been doing it that long and in these different contexts and whatnot.
Well, I was thinking about the role of tension and release in their music and in jam music in general.
Sure.
You know, the kind of concept of building something to a specific musical place that evokes a kind of tension and then kind of releasing that tension through a kind of musical peak, a kind of high energy moment.
Sure.
Or by, you know, creating dissonance and then bringing it back to a place of sort of kind of harmony or a kind of more melodic playing. And it's not that that's absent in Moe's music, but they are far more, I think, kind of about conversant playing and playing between members that is very kind of conversational and driving and building.
I think it's really true. And you know, that goes like they really have kind of an emphasis on the song writing in their music as well in so many ways, you know what I mean? Where it is sort of about the words, about the chords, about like, you know, now this is this guy's solo, now this is this guy's solo, you know, among other things, you know. But it was really, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And and you're right, just generally speaking, it's funny. It's like the formula is simple, right? You start here, meaning like with this energy, you know, and then you bring it here. I'm raising my hand for those of you who can't see, which is all of you, to here, you know, and whatever. But it's so interesting how many times, you know, you say that and you think that and you want to pull that off, but it falls short.
Sure.
And as simple a concept as that may be, obviously we know it takes so many different forms and, you know, it never kind of ceases to be interesting, whether or not it ends up being what you hope or reaching the heights that you hope it will. You know what I mean? It's very interesting in that way, you know, and that's why it just keeps us coming back for more iBooks. It just keeps us coming back for more.
Absolutely. Well, yesterday you announced a batch of dates with the band Guster. I know this is very highly anticipated for you and I'm very excited about it myself. What can you tell us?
Thanks, pal. Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the band Guster. I'm wildly excited to hit the road with them for, I believe it's 7 shows at the end of March into early April. And they're like the nicest band of all time. Every single member I would consider a dear friend of mine, which is awesome and usually not the case. Like, you know, sometimes, you know, oh, you're friends with the bassist and the drummer, but not the other, like for whatever reason, but they're all like just so wonderful. And my guitar player, Adam November, is a like lifelong diehard Guster fan, as are like his parents and his sisters. Like they're like a Guster family, so they are freaking out about this hot goss, which is very, you know, brings me a lot of joy to be able to like foster that for them, you know what I mean? That's really, really cool. So super stoked. And Raleigh,
yep,
Norfolk, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You have them in front of you, Isaac?
I do, yes. It starts in Raleigh at the Lincoln Theater on March 28th.
Which, fun fact, the Lincoln Theater in Raleigh, North Carolina was my first ever non-tri-state area gig I ever played. So that's very sort of, I like little things like that. I think it's really great.
And the Norva in Norfolk, Virginia is, Norfolk, Virginia, sorry, is a storied venue in its own right.
And was also on that same tour for me, same routing, and on, like, quite literally one of my, like, I literally only played it one time, opening in 2012, and I have thought about it ever since. It still remains, like, I haven't even seen it since then. We're talking over a decade, and I still consider it one of my favorite venues I've ever played. And it lit, like, I think that, like, I might be dreaming, but there's, like, a hot tub and a basketball court and an arcade. Like,
I just remember you coming back from that feeling very hyped on,
oh my God,
everything it was about.
Well, that was my first sort of taste of what became my drug of choice. Excitement. You know what I mean? Like, that was my first, what being on the road and being a touring musician feels like. Like, you sort of chase, and it's not, it's also, it's a series of false peaks, as we know. Like, it's not about getting somewhere or, like, you know, getting bigger and selling more tickets and being more this or being more that. It's literally, you get addicted to this sort of adrenaline thing that happens to you, where you kind of, you lay a little bit dormant during the day, and you're setting up, and you're traveling, whatever. And then by night, you get on stage, you play your music, people go crazy, you meet people, you celebrate, and then you pack it up, and you do it all over again the next day. You know what I mean? And that was my first ever real exposure to that. That was my first tour. And I remember coming back and just, like, it does something to your brain chemistry. It really does. Like, it shouldn't be overlooked how absolutely addictive and, like medical, like, it literally is, like, it really changes your, like, brain chemistry. And you just, I mean, if you like it, I could see not liking it, but I like it, you know what I mean? And, like, I will go to, like, crazy lengths to keep doing it, you know what I mean? And I remember coming back from those shows, and that was Lincoln Theater, Norva, Irving Plaza, 930 Club, like, a lot of shit that, like, you know, 17-year-old me was like, holy fucking shit, that is crazy. And yeah, it's just cool to return to those places, you know, 10 years later and just be like, holy tits, let's go. Wow, and with one of my favorite bands and, like, the nicest dudes ever. So really excited about that. And then where does the tour keep going, Isaac?
March 31st at the Paramount in Huntington, New York.
Ooh, a place you and I used to go to quite a bit in high school, sort of, right?
Sort of, yeah. I remember when it opened.
I remember when it opened. We saw Marilyn Manson there.
We saw the disgraced and failing Marilyn Manson there.
We sure did, but it was pretty awesome back then. I saw a lot of metal bands there. I saw Joe Walsh there. I saw Humphreys McGee, right? Yep. Like, lot of, I don't know, I feel like there was definitely a period of time where I was going, and so much so that I knew that you take the train from here to Cold Spring, not Huntington, and it gets you there faster, which is, like, a hot tip, you know?
Sure, so you'd think you'd take it to Huntington.
Wouldn't you?
I saw a great Slayer show there.
That is fucking sick, yeah.
That was cool.
I saw Testament and Anthrax there, sure. For sure. Yeah, a lot of metal, man. A lot of metal. We love it.
Then the Columbus Theater in Providence, Rhode Island, and the Lebanon Opera House in
New Hampshire.
Lebanon, New Hampshire, right?
Oh, yeah.
And both of those shows are sold out. Then Northampton, White Eagle Hall in Jersey City, and I will be at that show. That wraps it up.
That's so fun.
I don't really know Guster, but I'm really going to dig into the catalog ahead of this.
I'm going to make you a playlist. I've been really actually enjoying, like, I'm not going to front, like, I know every Guster tune at all. Like, I'm not that guy, but there's so much to enjoy in their music, and I think you'll really, like, if you get into it, you're gonna really, really dig it. Great songs and great just records, you know, which is super great. So stoked about that. And yeah, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a you know, any desire to host 3 or 4 very well-behaved lunatics in, say, Norfolk, Virginia, or Providence, Rhode Island, or know somebody with an illustrious guest house, just get in touch. Just let me know. That would be really fun for me. So, you know, let me know. Otherwise, we are just stoked to hit the road. And it's been a great, like, you know, to think we've spent the year opening for the Disco Biscuits, Mo, and now Guster is just really sweet, you know? I've had a really nice time playing with some of my, you know, heroes.
Do you think there will be sit-ins on the Guster tour?
Yes. In fact, the fellas all already like when these shows got confirmed, were like, you know, sort of talking about that. And that's exciting because, you know, Guster is an interesting band. Like, there's not a jammy bone in Guster's body if you were to ask me. You know, they're like a very like college 90s radio rock band that very much has, you know, it started in Boston at Tufts and has very much sort of grassroots origins. And like, definitely they like, you know, had, they hit the ground running and like hit the pavement and made a friend out of all of their fans, which is a beautiful thing, you know, and they've kept them for quite a long time. And it's an incredible, I don't know, they've built this kind of wonderful empire of Guster fans that are diehard and still are, you know, which is beautiful. And I think they, as much as they don't fall into the category, they don't fall into a lot of categories, you know what I mean? They sort of defy, they created their sort of own universe, which is something that I think most musicians aspire to do, and they've really done it successfully, which I think is really amazing. And there is sort of just a collaborative spirit in them, you know what I mean? And you know, Ryan Miller, the front man, he's a dear friend. He's out there, like, you know, takes the mic into the crowd and runs and interacts with everybody, and it's a special band, man. I really look forward to that. And of course, Lord knows on this podcast, we will be talking about Guster every week until then. So that's going to be great. It's going to be great for me.
Well, speaking of the collaborative spirit,
yeah,
a very special collaboration happened at the Bridgestone Arena in Nashville, Tennessee on Saturday when Billy Strings and Derek Trucks met for the first time on stage during Billy's show. But what was set break at Derek's Tedeschi Trucks Band show at the Ryman just a few blocks away.
Dude, I mean, the idea that you're taking your set break to do something so awesome is just, that's like, that's so exciting. I don't know. It's obviously exciting for everybody at the arena. But like, I don't know, the feeling of like being Derek, you put your guitar down, you just played a bunch of incredibly searing music for the people. And then you probably, like, you know, people are like, go, 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 go. And you get put in a car and then driven backstage and then taken. And then, you know, and then you're just like, boom, at this whole other venue, stepping into a whole other vibe.
A sold out arena.
You got to be losing your mind.
You like, have to be losing your mind.
Just like, talk about addicted to the excitement. It's just like, you're just like, oh, shit. Like, that's that sort of like mission. You know, like he like went on a mission to go across the street and sit in with Billy. So
and they
cool.
played Picking Up the Pieces by Widespread Panic, which I think is a very cool thing for them to collaborate on.
It's incredible.
I saw a video of Billy and his band backstage like talking about what it means to be playing arenas. And they're like, how does Widespread Panic do it? And then somebody points out, well, they have a drummer. And Billy goes, yeah, and it's Dwayne Trucks. And they're like, I don't know, kind of having this like psyching themselves up and psyching themselves out moment. And, you know, it must have been amazing for Billy to play these two nights at the sold out Bridgestone Arena and then go across the street to the Ryman and play a full Sunday service of traditional bluegrass music.
Incredible. With you know, style to the nines.
Style to the nines, looking like the Grand Ole Opry.
Devils in the details.
And it just seemed like a great weekend to be in Nashville, Tennessee.
So cool. And allegedly, you know, Billy said into the mic, that was the first time that he and Derek were meeting.
Yes.
That is next level in this.
Completely. And know? He also said that at some point he just dropped his pick because he was just blown away by what Derek was playing.
Dude. And Derek, a legendary pickless player, you know? That was a subliminal trying to do what he's doing.
Right. Completely. Yes.
Very
interesting. Yeah. It's a kind of unconscious communication.
He was like, oh shit, he's not playing a pick.
That's really funny.
Super cool. Would have obviously loved to been at love to have been at either of these incredible shows. Perhaps both. I would have pulled a Derek and just been like, bah, 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 I'm going there, I'm going here, here's set break, here's set one, set two. Incredible shit. Billy never ceases to amaze us on this podcast. We just keep on reporting about all the cool ass shit he's up to because he's doing some cool ass shit every week. It's unbelievable.
Well, the Ryman was tacked on as a kind of intimate experience after playing two sold out arena nights, and it seems to be more and more common that bands will add a more intimate show to a tour.
Yeah.
That is otherwise surrounded by big theaters or arenas. And I just saw Jack White play Brooklyn Steel last Wednesday, and we are both going to see the National play the very intimate Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York, a place where I've only seen Soul Live and Assembly of Dust.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess it's always happened that there have been underplays, there have been tour warm-up rehearsal things, but especially in this, you know, post-COVID world, or, you know, it feels like a kind of even more rare opportunity or treasured opportunity to see an artist you love to see on a big stage do something in a kind of intimate, you know, I don't know what the National show will be like, but maybe kind of almost rehearsing-like style.
Sure.
Yeah, it's real.
I think they're going to play their whole, you know, yet to be released record in its entirety, and they've only released, I believe, 2 singles from it, so that'll be just kind of special and awesome in its own right. And I agree with you, Isaac. It's really like it's one of those things, and of course, like, you know, to see a band that usually plays in front of, you know, 10, 20,000 people, whatever it might be, in front of just a few hundred is really fascinating, you know, and it's just cool to see. I don't know. I have that experience sort of when you see sort of heroes or masters of the craft, like, you know, rehearsing, you know, or like trying to figure out a part in front of you. And you're just like, oh, you're just like me. Like, you try to figure out these parts just like I do, and you struggle over them just like I do. You know what I mean? There's something very humanizing about taking somebody who's usually playing on arena stages and putting them in a 400 cap club and watching them, as you say, perhaps even rehearse their set, you know, and rehearse their new album, and not, you know, feel the pressure of, you know, 15,000 of their fans kind of, you know, and wanting to give everybody the bang for their buck and show everybody, like, you know, the greatest, you know, large scale production performance ever. It's like really cool to see it kind of not toned down, but smaller. That's really cool. So I look forward to seeing that. It's so cool you got to see Jack White. Everybody's been talking about the show.
It was terrific. I mean, he is definitely a force, and he came out swinging to a place where I think he surprised himself at how rambunctious he was the moment he got on stage, and it was just kind of on from the first moment, and you know, some real tried and true Jack White fans in the building, and I got to share the experience with my brother, and we, you know, grew up on the White Stripes. And
your brother loves the White Stripes so much, or rather your brother loves Jack White so much that his Instagram handle forever was Blunderbuss, which is a reference to a Jack White record that, like, isn't even that storied, you
yes,
know what I mean?
Yeah, no, my brother really loves Jack White, and we were, you know, I don't know, it was definitely a kind of wild experience to feel at once nostalgic and see Jack do something new and be in a small room and, you know, also just kind of taking the tour for the first time. Like, it would be a show I'd be glad to go see in an arena,
yeah.
And here I was at this sort of, like, coveted moment.
So cool.
So that was really, definitely a highlight. And you know, I guess Dead and Company is teasing what is sure to also be a special and intimate whatever it is. They
yes.
posted to, I guess, their social media channels.
Basically, it was a, like, every member of the band, right?
Yes.
And Dead and Company themselves posted, you know, a C-23 with a lightning bolt, you know, with 5/8/23 as the caption, essentially,
right.
Which of course, you know, harkens back to Burton Hall, Cornell,
1977.
It is a very famous Scarlet Fire.
It's a very famous show.
It's a very famous
recording. It's very, you know, it's there's conspiracy theories about this show. The, you know, tape is in the Library of Congress. It's very kind of special show for a lot of reasons. Of course, Dead and Company are on their advertised final tour.
Sure.
The anniversary of the Barton Hall show comes on the Monday after the band plays Jazz Fest.
Very, very cool. Something's afoot, and I honestly, I'm a big fan of the, you know, the teaser in this regard. I gotta say, like, it definitely got me ever so slightly revved up. I'm out here wondering what the fuck is gonna go down, and do the kids at Cornell need to get hip to what's about to happen because they're about to have 100,000 barefoot hippies dancing on their lawn.
Well, I was also wondering, like, that's around the time of graduation. So, like, are they going to play Graduation?
I mean, is everybody right now just, like, online buying an Ithaca is Gorgeous t-shirt? And
I think they're booking hotel rooms.
People must be, right?
I don't know if it's going to be a pay-per-view webcast thing. It probably will be webcast no matter what.
Sure. But will there be an in-the-flesh component to this?
And can we get there? Trucking up to Ithaca.
5'8", dude. I mean, one of the best parts about 5877 is the sort of, what's it called, needlepoint, like, thing. I don't know if you've seen this. This is like definition, just like sort of hippie paraphernalia that I literally see everywhere and at every festival, but it just is like needlepoint or like crocheted. I don't know how, you know, whatever. And it just says, in this house, we fuck to 5877.
I'm telling you, this is a very, a very storied thing.
You gotta love it. Well, whatever's happening, Dead & Co., we know it's the final year. We know they're trying to go out with a bang, do something special. And not going to lie to you, it sounds pretty special, Isaac. I'm really looking forward to seeing what it is. And Lord knows we will be covering it right here on Inappropriate Happiness when we find out.
Because what would it be if we didn't?
And on that note, we would like to shout out our mainest man, RJB, back at Osiris HQ. RJ, we hope you had a great time in Fish, Mexico. And we hope you are eating something great for dinner tonight.
I was going to say sipping on something good, whether it be a coffee or a beer or a sparkling beverage of some sort.
Oh, sparkling. Yeah, absolutely. We hope you are staying strapped. We hope you are, you know, just you know, being the cool-ass motherfucker that we know you are out there in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, one of my favorite cities. I can't wait to go there again, actually. Holy shit. You're awesome. Isaac, you're awesome. Inappropriate Happiness loves you, baby. This has been incredible. We've talked about all kinds of shit. In this house, we fucked to 5877.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I've been jumping turnstiles, hailing taxis with intent. Do you need directions? I bet it's not
way. Osiris. This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app
and subscribe now.